Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Jack Lepiarz. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by the Boston University Pardee School of Global Studies titled Eating Women, the Regulation of Milk and Placenta Consumption in France and the United States. Our speaker is Matilda Cohen, professor of law at the University of Connecticut. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, Boston University professor of law Daniela Caruso.
I'm going to tell you that I am thrilled to have Professor Matilda Cohen from the University of Connecticut to present her work now titled, Provocatively Eating Women. I'll never forget this title. What I would like to do is to invite Professor Cohen to give the highlights of her life and her career that are most relevant to this talk and pick the ones that are more meaningful to her. So, please. Thank you.
Well, thanks so much, Daniela and Elizabeth, for inviting me here, and for all of you for coming here voluntarily or involuntarily. I'm thrilled to be here to talk about eating women, which obviously is a provocative or hyperbolic way to refer to the consumption of human milk and human placenta and their regulation. So, this is actually my godmother, my Italian godmother, who is awesome. And this is a picture she masterminded, not for this project, but she let me use it, which I'm grateful for. And how did I come to this project? I first came to milk when I had my first child in 2013, and I was on a mailing list of parents. And I kept seeing parents saying, I'm looking for human milk, I can buy it, or please give it to me for free, or I have extra human milk, who wants it? And as a law professor, I immediately started wondering, how is this regulated? I knew that cow's milk is one of the most heavily regulated food products in the United States and worldwide, and so I thought, let's look at how human milk is regulated. Turned out not much in this country. So that was my first foray into this. And a few years later, still in that neighborhood, Brooklyn, New York, of course. Not only do parents exchange human milk, but other parents tell me, what, you didn't eat your placenta after you gave birth? My placenta. And I discovered eating your placenta is a thing. And of course, I wondered, how is this regulated? So here we are. What interests me today is to think about these two substances as part of a gendered bioeconomy that is both local in the form of self-consumption and peer-to-peer markets and global because milk, for example, has been shipped across borders. As you see in this headline, Cambodian milk used to be imported in the United States, and until a decade ago, a number of European countries used to sell their placentas to American U.S. companies. So these are two gendered substances, again, highly tied to reproduction. They're typically produced by women, though not only. Happy to talk about that in the Q&A. I use the word woman here, but I don't mean to exclude people who don't identify as women or as any gender and who do produce milk and who do grow placentas. It's easier, of course, to use the word women, but I also use it conscious of the gender politics in the sense that these are products, the producers of which are subordinated because they are feminized, whether or not they themselves identify as women. So these products are typically the result of pregnancy and birth, and for me, they're really part of a broader conversation about reproductive justice, even though often the conversation is centered upon contraception and abortion. I think we should think about reproductive rights more broadly to encompass rights to a birth of your choice and rights to what you do with your placenta and rights and support for breastfeeding. But that may be beyond the scope of this talk. What I'm interested in is The question of who is being eaten when milk and placenta are being eaten. Are you eating yourself? Are you eating someone else? Is milk the property of the person who produces it? Is it the property of the baby? Is it the property of the community? Similarly, is placenta fetal or maternal tissue? Who should have access to placenta? These are some of the questions animating this project. I'm also interested in thinking about these two substances as ways in which the female body gets fragmented. So Emily Martin, a famous anthropologist, wrote a book nearly three decades ago, The Woman in the Body, in which she shows that in its reproductive capacity, the female body tends to be fragmented, and women tend to feel they lack control. And so milk and placenta are interesting because they're sites of fragmentation, but as I will also show, sites of empowerment for women who reclaim them for themselves and their kin. So this is not primarily a project about Europe. In fact, I did some field work in both Europe and the United States, mostly in France, my home country, as you can hear. So it's not necessarily primarily a comparative project, but I think these are two substances in which some of the distinctions between regulatory regimes in the U.S. and Europe are particularly apparent. So I'll start by telling you more about who eats these things and why. Then I'll talk about how they're regulated in these two regions. And then I'll raise a series of broader questions about them, if I have the time to. So my first question is why and how do people consume milk and placenta? So the first reason is spiritual or religious. As some of you may or may not know, planting the placenta or burying a placenta is a common postpartum ritual in many cultures from Asia, Oceania, Africa, and also in America. So a number of nations on the land of whom we currently stand right now, including the Pawtucket, the Massachusetts, and the Pocantucket people, used, and some of them still plant the placenta as a form of postpartum spiritual practice, the idea being that planting the placenta creates a relationship between the new human and their community. There are also nutritional reasons why people eat these products. So milk is humans' primary food. And it's not only a food for infants, but it has always been a food for adults to some extent. And it's provocatively being served as a food for adults in some contexts. For example, this is a London ice cream maker who used his wife's ice cream to make a Baby Gaga flavor before he got shut down by the health department after 7 days. But it seemed pretty fun while it lasted. Placenta are also food. The etymology of the word is enlightening. It comes from the Latin placenta, which means cake. It is a pound of rich meat. This is a nutrition fact label that some researchers made for placenta. So as you see, it's the new superfood, high protein, low fat, no sugar, and lots of iron. So it's increasingly popular among postpartum women who believe it will have not only nourishing effects, but also antidepressant effects and facilitate lactation. So it's consumed raw or encapsulated. So the placenta is half a pound of meat. So instead of eating it all at once, the current trend is to hire an encapsulator, get it dehydrated, ground, and put into capsules, which you can pop over the course of weeks or months. So this use intersects with a broader, what I would call broader medical use of milk and placenta. So human milk for the longest time used to be the most potent antibiotic naturally available to humans. It was and is still used to cure infections, wounds, and all sorts of other ailments. And today it's considered the standard medicine for premature babies. Placenta has also a long history of medicinal uses, and it is now at the forefront of regenerative medicine. And just like milk, it's being used as a source of stem cells. Finally, these two products are used for cosmetic purposes. So milk is touted as the wonder cosmetic beauty treatment. Here it's used as a milk facial. Placenta is also very popular in cosmetics, especially in East Asia, for anti-aging and whitening, skin whitening uses, which we'll talk about later if we have time. So the question is, how are these products regulated and how do they circulate among people? So there's a striking contrast here between the U.S. sort of laissez-faire approach and the overall restrictive European approach. And it's a contrast that many people have already observed in other contexts, in particular in the context of assisted reproductive technology. So I want to say a little bit more about the regulation on both sides of the Atlantic and then try to draw some or ask some questions about that. So first, there's internal diversity in both regions. So though the European Union has increased its engagement with the regulation of human materials, national regulators typically retain a lot of power, and they are not required to follow the Commission's conclusions. For example, the conclusion concluded that milk is a tissue, but some European countries don't choose to regulate it as a tissue. The EU doesn't have any stance on placenta, though former member, the UK, thought placenta was a novel food and therefore subject to a requirement of authorization. What's interesting, though, is that the European Union Charter and the Human Tissue Directive both have a strong anti-commodification view. They clearly state that within the region, people should not buy or sell these products. So this is an example of what Viviana Zelizer has dubbed the hostile world argument in the context of intimacy. So the fear of turning the body into a tradable commodity and eroding moral values, and something about which Professor Guseva has a lot to say in the context of surrogacy. France, my home country, has a particularly extreme version of this European approach in that they have enacted laws specifically prohibiting any form of ownership over the body and any type of transaction over the body. So you can't even donate your milk in France because it would violate the principle of ownership and it would violate the principle of anonymity. So you can donate your milk via a national milk bank that will anonymize it, but you can't donate it to a friend or peer-to-peer or online. So it's fascinating because France is the country of wet nurses. Until the 70s, there was still law in the books about wet nurses. And all wet nursing regulation, this is the code of wet nurses from the 18th century, was all about how much you should pay your wet nurse, when, what happens if you don't pay her, does she get time off, etc. So we've gone from a regime of extreme milk commodification to a regime where now you can't possibly even donate milk for free to your neighbor. It would be completely immoral and illegal. In the U.S. too, there's a broad diversity in how these products are defined, but what's fascinating to me is the lack of definition of both these products. So human milk is not defined by federal law, even though cow's milk is clearly defined in the Code of Federal Regulation. And similar to milk, the status of placenta is completely unclear, but most often than not, it ends up being treated as a biohazard and falls under waste management regulation. So the result of this contrast is that laissez-faire in the U.S. means that there's a robust self-consumption and peer-to-peer market here, whereas in Europe, there's a robust public or publicly subsidized network of banks that redistribute these products under national regulation. So I'll first say a bit about the institutionalized market. So you see on the one hand that this is the contrast between people storing milk in their fridge that they got from friends or they bought online versus neatly bottled milk that they got from a milk bank. France has more public and publicly subsidized milk banks than the United States, even though the United States is 6 times larger and more populous and has a higher birth rate. And you could get, if it's indicated for your baby, milk free of charge from a French milk bank. Whereas here, all the milk banks are private, nonprofit or for-profit companies, but even nonprofit milk could run you about $70 to $140 per day, and if you had to turn to a commercial milk company, a lot more. Things are similar in the placenta world in the sense that in Europe generally, you cannot bank your placenta for personal use. You can only bank it for public use, whereas in the U.S., if you're willing to pay thousands of dollars, you could bank your own placenta for your own future use. But it gets even weirder. It's that in France, you do not even own your placenta. So if you give birth at a medical facility, you're prohibited from taking it back. And so this is a newspaper article saying, he steals the placenta of his wife who just delivered her baby. We've actually seen similar cases in the U.S. of hospitals preventing people from accessing their placenta, but it is changing, and there is a movement in favor of change. If you look at peer-to-peer markets, it's the opposite. So there are peer-to-peer markets and forms of self-consumption in Europe, but they're much less developed than in the U.S., where they're completely unregulated and very easy to access. So what's the upshot? It seems like in the United States, by and large, people enjoy greater agency over their own body material, but there's perhaps less redistribution across different people, as we will talk about later. Whereas in Europe, there's less self-ownership, but more publicly mediated redistribution of body products. Why these differences? I'm curious to hear your thoughts. I'm sure you have many suggestions. Just to state one quickly, there's a major political economy divide here in the sense that European countries have been built upon natalist anxieties in the past centuries. There was always this fear of not reproducing the nation, especially white, strong white babies to maintain white European supremacy. And so there was always this high level of state intervention in reproductive choices, sometimes in a very negative way, but sometimes in a positive way, in as much as it provided parents with support to actually reproduce when they wanted to. And relatedly, health is considered a basic entitlement in Europe, so there's a more developed health system that yields these public banks. So what do I want to talk about now? I want to talk about three broader overarching questions. The first is the idea of reproductive consumption. The second is the question of inequalities in access in terms of class and race. And the third is about the vilification by public health authorities and regulators of self-consumption and peer-to-peer markets. So first, reproductive consumption. What do I mean by that? I borrow the expression from Ruth Fletcher, who has shown how reproduction in our day and age tends to be shaped by consumption. So being pregnant in affluent societies is about which prenatal test you're going to purchase, which doctor's office you're going to choose, which prenatal yoga class you're going to go to. And what's really fascinating to me about milk and placenta is that here, reproductive consumption is doubly reproductive because you're consuming the own product of your reproduction. And this is partly emancipatory and partly reinforcing of neoliberal agenda. So it's emancipatory, as sociologist Charlotte Kralacher has shown, in the sense that, remember I started by saying women can feel fragmented in the process of making babies. Well, though milk and placenta are fragments of themselves, these are fragments you can choose to repossess and use in the way you want, be it to consume them yourself, bang them, sell them, do something with them. And in that sense, one of the placenta encapsulation companies that is thriving in the UK has equated placenta encapsulation with a pro-choice stance. It's my choice what to do with my placenta. At the same time, it is reinforcing of consumption, because milk sharing and eating your placenta themselves reinscribe participants within metaphors of Western individualism and capitalism. It's about what breast pump you're going to buy or what placenta encapsulator you're going to hire. So just to me, this tension is really interesting. The second tension that I find less interesting but more worrisome is the tension between sharing and excluding. Milk consumption and placenta consumption are often framed as relational practices. So milk and placenta, if you were in a metaphysics class or philosophy class, let's say, how would you define milk and placenta? They're not independent substances. They're substances that are liminal, produced by and for two people. So you can't, for example, produce milk for much, very long time, unless you have the stimulus of a suckling baby. Milk is a co-production between an adult and a baby. Similarly, placenta is a co-production between a pregnant person and a fetus. And in deciding to eat them yourself or share them with others, you create other types of relations. But what's really worrisome, based on the research that's being conducted in the U.S., is that who engages in those practices, basically affluent, white, educated women who have the time and money to invest in those practices. So if you think eating your placenta is something completely kooky, it's not too much, you might not be too concerned about it, except when you remember that placenta eating or placenta planting used to be a traditional aspect of many cultures that now tend to be subordinated in our culture. But for human milk, it's very problematic when you consider that for premature and sick babies, donor human milk is really a scarce resource in this country and in other countries, and it tends to be scarcely distributed and mostly among race and class lines. Racial stratification is particularly apparent in the market for placenta-based cosmetics. So this is something that you don't see so much in the U.S. anymore because the FDA has cracked down on placenta-based cosmetics. But in Korea and Japan, there are numbers of companies that market whitening creams that are potentially harmful because they haven't really been tested. So these creams contain human placenta extracts and are sold on the premise that they will lighten your skin tone, so reinforcing racial hierarchies and coloring. And what sociologist Margaret Hunter has shown exemplifies the tendency to put people in a position to want to buy racial capital because they live in a culture in which you can't move forward if you don't have that racial capital. So this was the second tension I wanted to talk about before concluding by wondering what the law is doing or not doing or should be doing about all of this. What I find striking is that regulators seem to only worry about one thing, health and safety. It's always about policing self-consumption and peer-to-peer markets as bad because of the risks involved. So it would be bad to share your milk because it could be contaminated with viruses, bacteria, et cetera. It's bad to eat your placenta because it could be contaminated with viral infections. It could have this or that. So I'm not dismissing the health risks. I think, of course, these practices involve health risks. But I'm suspicious of the regulators' focus on that issue rather than the redistributive issue. So who gets to access to those resources and how to equalize access if we think they're valuable, and also of generally the lack of support for people to make choices about their body and their reproduction. Because one way also of seeing part of what is going on here is that giving birth is a site of intense anxiety. It has always been, and it is today, especially because lots of people lack support. And focusing on these two products is a sort of an anxiety release mechanism. And the law is doing nothing to make it easier for people to have babies, and the law is doing nothing, or not much, to ensure that, in particular, human milk get redistributed equally and that people do get access to their placentas. Because I'm not saying people should be eating their placentas, but I think if they want to, they should be able to. I'd love to see change in that direction. And for now, I think I'm just going to stop now and look forward to, I have lots more to say, but I'm really curious to hear about your thoughts. So thank you so much.
Thank you. We lots to talk about here. To start the discussion, we have Dr. Ivana Izailovic, who is a visiting scholar. She works on women's gender and sexuality, and she's affiliated with Northeastern University and the School of Law of Northeastern University. Thank you, Ivana.
Thank you so much, Mathilde, this provocative talk. I never thought about, placenta consumption and milk consumption, and let alone how it is regulated under U.S. and French law. So thank you for that. So Danielle asked me to maybe talk a little bit about the gender dimension and especially the difference between the United States and France as I see it. So I think that the way I'm going to do that is to go back to your question, how do we understand or how do we justify the fact that in the United States we have a laissez-faire while in France we have a stringent or very strict regulation. And I think that in a way it probably overlaps, but there are other people in this group who could also give us their views on that. But it overlaps, I think, with one thing that we have in France, the way we understand gender, is deeply colored with the anti-commodification kind of movement. So this is something that is very present in feminist, French feminist movements, the idea that there are certain things that we cannot buy, that we cannot sell. Today, I know that you're going to talk about surrogacy later, but maybe, okay. But right now, if you look at the debate that we have around surrogacy, it's very similar to what you're describing. So we, in France, surrogacy is prohibited, and one strong argument in favor of that is that it is the commodification of a woman's body. And major French feminists support that position, so there are things that we cannot sell and buy. The other hand, what we have here is the emphasis on autonomy and agency. So U.S. feminists see commodification arguments like something that is suspect because it is used in order to disenfranchise women economically. So we can think about, family law cases in which the husband and the wife agreed that the husband will pay his wife for any domestic work that she does. The court will say, this is something that you do out of love. We're not going to, we are not going to compensate that kind of work. So what feminists are saying is basically commodification, the anti-commodification argument, what it does is that it deprives women of compensation for the work that they're doing. Now, I think that what you're describing when you talk about the reproductive consumption, the tension that you're describing, on the one hand, we have feminists who are saying this is selling your placenta or selling your milk is something that is emancipatory, and others who are saying, well, it's actually dovetails with neoliberal logic. I think that you're describing something that feminists like Nancy Fraser and more recently Catherine Rottenberg described as the rise of neoliberal feminism. What it means is that every aspect of women's lives are seen as commodities, and that we are basically urging women collectively through discourse, through regulation, to invest in their all aspects of their lives. One of them being, of course, motherhood, that is seen as something that is similar to management. So in general, she looks at some of the most prominent books right now, Ivanka Trump's book, I guess the title is Women Who Work, but also Sheryl Sandberg's book, Leonin, and Anne Mary Slaughter's book on work-life balance. And she argues that what we actually see is this idea that women need to invest constantly in every aspect of their life. And what this neoliberal feminism does is that it produces a neoliberal subject that is seen as human capital, as a commodity. So I just wanted to kind of see you reflect on some of these ideas and tell us more about the tension that you see, the reproductive consumption that you described. And the second question that I had has to do with comparative law. Sorry for those of you who are not comparative lawyers, but I was wondering, so in your comparative law work, what you do is that you mix law with history, sociology. It's extremely refreshing. It's extremely interesting to read your work in comparative law. And your methodology is extremely different from what we see usually in comparative law law work. So I was wondering, what are some of the obstacles that you face, and how do you see in general comparative law moving forward as a discipline based on the research that you've done?
Thanks so much for this. It's super helpful and interesting. I'll start with your second question on my methodology. I'm basically a closeted sociologist, so when I'm interested in these things, I do a lot of very participatory observation. So in the context of milk, I gave my milk to people. I didn't tell it, but I gave it to get access to these underground networks. And for placenta, was my second pregnancy, because now I knew this was a thing. Mm-hmm. I was actually more worried about my placenta than the baby, which was infuriated everyone around me, because I interviewed a number of encapsulators because I wanted to find... I couldn't encapsulate it five times. I had to find an encapsulator who came to my apartment so I could see how they do it. She could tell me about who her clients were. And so when it was time to deliver the baby, I was like, do we have ice for the placenta? Do we have a bag for the placenta? So that's my methodology. Though it doesn't always make it into the articles, because, of course, I need to get them published. But to respond to your second question, it also means that a lot of my edgy work doesn't get published really fast. It takes me a while to get these things published until I find the right journal or write editors, because it really doesn't fit within the standard conception of what comparative law is and should be. As for your substantive question, I really appreciate your linking this to neoliberal feminism, and I would say what's fascinating with placenta and milk is that it shows that women's investment in themselves and their children is expected to start earlier and earlier. So now, as soon as you get pregnant, if you're a good, affluent mother, you're expected to immediately start researching what you will do to your placenta and what's the responsible thing to do with your placenta. Is it to bank it privately, spending thousands of dollars for your future offspring, or is it to keep it for yourself and eat it? Similarly, with your milk, you have to invest in your child being fed human milk. So if you can't produce enough milk for a reason or another, the expectation is that you will do everything you can to get this child donor human milk, even though it could cost you a fortune, you could drive for hours in the wilderness to get it from someone, etc. And I think there's investment in yourself and really also investment in your children. It's contemporary motherhood is really about what Linda Gordon, the historian, said. It's about putting children first. So it's always all these social and legal norms are in my view, always premised on the putative welfare of the children, not so much their parents. So it's about what's good for children, hence the health and safety obsession, I think. But that's just my take.
So let's invite to the podium also Professor Guseva, who's a professor of sociology here at Boston University. Thank you very much. And then we'll open it up to the public.
Thanks. Thank you. Thank you, Matilde. It was a very interesting talk. I know some stuff, but some of that sort of was kind of eye-opening. I guess I had my kids before that became a thing. Either of those things became a thing, so I never quite participated in the market like this. But in my own work, I study surrogacy, commercial surrogacy, not in the U.S., but post-Soviet space in Russia, Ukraine, Kazakhstan. And generally speaking, as an economic sociologist, I conceptualize these spaces as, these markets rather, as fields. And so my first question always when I encounter something like this, and you sort of talk about some changes that are happening. So, for example, women are protesting the limitations on selling their own milk in France, or there's this emergence of encapsulators. I've never heard of companies like this, but it makes sense. So my basic, very basic question when I encounter something like this is, who are the actors? Who actually is driving this process? Both in terms of like the incentives to sell things, but also in terms of like putting some ground rules, right? Because I imagine there's probably certain kinds of conflicts or battles around morality, around safety, which also can be moralized, right? And around maybe making profit. There's you know, one other possible sort of moral battle is actually this. I didn't quite understand. I think there's a few things you talked about, and somehow they're mixed up in my head. So, for example, there are cases when women consume their own placentas. But there's also cases when hospitals, you said, used to sell placentas for commercial use. So hospitals basically commodified and commercialized something that was essentially deemed as waste. So there's some revenue stream for the hospitals, perhaps, that sort of went to, you know, biotech or pharmaceutical companies or skincare companies that did this kind of thing. So to me, these are different things. Eating your own placenta is very different from turning it into a market. Say, sharing your milk with someone peer-to-peer or a friend or a neighbor is very different from, you know, being in Cambodia and sort of participating in this on an industrial scale. So for me, another moral debate, and this is something actually I'm noticing in my research on surrogacy, that oftentimes for people within the surrogacy market who have gone, you know, beyond the argument whether commodification is good or bad, because they're in the market already, the difference they make between morally redeeming, say, surrogacy and surrogacy, or good surrogacy and bad surrogacy, essentially moral boundaries they draw, are between kind of small-scale relational practices where sort of individuals are treated as individuals and kind of more large-scale production that some actually, with penchant for flowery language, compare to animal husbandry. So there's frequently metaphors relating to like cattle or chicken farm or something like that come up. And for them, that's not the kind of surrogacy. And most of those people, I have to say, are prominent doctors. And in the surrogacy field, they try to downplay the scale of the market specifically so that they can say, well, we only do it in small number of cases. It's a necessary procedure, but nobody's interested in making it into, expanding it into kind of a, like an assembly line type thing, right? And of course, these are two extremes, but I think this question about what is the field, who the actors are, and what are the moral battles that they're fighting, because these are very morally charged processes, not only legally kind of controversial or illegal in many cases, but also morally so. I think kind of look at a variety of those things. Commodification is only one of them, but like scaling up, I think, is another. And also, as another example, it's not very clear who exactly are the end users. So sometimes it's women themselves, other times it's other women. But I know that in milk markets, men sometimes purchase milk for other purposes, like nutritional purposes. And I know from some advertisements that that becomes oftentimes a kind of a moral boundary for women that are willing to sell their own milk by saying, I'm only going to sell to other women, because some uses of these kinds of things are more moralized and others are denigrated, right? So there's a kind of a variety of ways in which you can structure the market in terms of who the actors are, what are they saying to one another, who is trying to be kind of in the lead in terms of organizing these markets. Like the encapsulated companies, very interesting. Who are they? You know, what's their background? How do they advertise? It sort of reminds me of the emerging market for social egg freezing. You know, the egg banks that are trying to kind of branch out of infertility patient market or demand to young women. And oftentimes their marketing practices are quite ingenious. You know, how do they access sort of groups of women within certain income bracket, certain age group, to kind of make this something that they want to undergo and pay for? You know, how do they create a sense of hope? How do they create a sense of, some kind of moral balance around taking control of your time, but also valuing motherhood and, you know, things like that? I think these are sort of my general comments in terms of, like, how I would want to structure this so that I can understand better what actually is going on and what are the boundaries of those kind of fields. One related question is this property which you raised. I think it's super interesting that that hospitals, by default, think of anything that gets out of your body in the process of medical treatment is not yours. It's the hospital property. I know you said that in the U.S. women can take their placentas, but this is recent. You know, it used to be by default that whenever it's taken out or chopped off or is a leftover procedure, it's not yours. I mean, even taking teeth from the dentist sometimes kind of like they're not used to people taking things off. There was a case I read about a guy, I don't know for what purpose, just, you know, he was strange. He wanted to take a limb that was amputated. Maybe you heard.
Yeah,
and I think
he
consumed it. But I don't remember which country that was. He ran into a lot of trouble because hospitals are not particularly open to the idea that we own anything that came of our body under those circumstances. I mean, I think sometimes it's difficult to get your medical record in the hospital. They don't think that you own it either. You know, it's they who own it.
Yeah, there are a number of cases on it. So thank you. This is great. And these are all questions I've written about, so I'm very happy.
I'm looking forward to reading
them. Yeah, I'm very happy that you raised them. On who are the actors? So there are a variety of actors. You're curious about encapsulators in particular. So there's an emerging sociology of encapsulators showing that they're typically moms, stay-at-home moms who want a revenue stream, and they've been described under the label mompreneurs. So just it's the same sociology as doulas, pre-postnatal yoga instructors. So it's this whole business around birth that is provided by these women mom who frame themselves as providing a service but also a form of care. And so it's very interesting the discourse that go with their services. They often organize in groups and cap the fee at a certain level so that it remains accessible to all, or sliding scale. So there's this whole discourse of we're here to help you. It's feminine solidarity. We're selling a service, but it's really for your own good, and we're like friends. We're friends as much as entrepreneurs.
But is it regulated? Are they licensed? Or is this completely under
Absolutely
the table?
Absolutely not. It's completely self-regulated. And it's also very interesting how the discourses they create to give the appearance of regulation. So in the U.S., for example, there are no less than 3 major placenta encapsulation businesses, and each of them claims they have their own certification training program. One of them has called their certification program the ultimate bachelor's degree in placenta arts.
Is there such a thing?
That's what they called their certification program, which is based on absolutely no. I mean, they follow typical safety protocols that you find in hospitals as to how to dispose of waste, etc. So there is some science base, but it's none of these organizations or programs have been vouched or vetted by any established medical authority. But they all use the rhetoric of certification, of science, of safety in order to promote their... So it's fascinating, and I feel like someone should and is probably already writing an entire book about them. So this is just one piece of the picture. The other thing I wanted to respond to is to your fascinating comparison with surrogacy in your own fieldwork, because I feel here it cuts across the scaling up cuts across the other way. So you have on the one hand peer-to-peer milk markets and placenta self-consumption, which is small scale, relational, individual, artisanal, versus human milk markets once they enter the realm of milk banks, including commercial milk banks, where milk is collected on a wide scale, pooled, processed, pasteurized, and put up on the market for extremely high prices. And similarly, placenta is no longer used for cosmetic products in the U.S., but it's an incredibly valuable tissue to produce drugs, medical therapies, and for research. And to this day, though, as I mentioned, some states have moved to protect people's right to reprocess their placenta, there are many hospitals and states where there's no such right, and hospitals benefit from classifying a tissue as waste and then being able to donated or give or sell it to organizations that will then use it for expensive therapy. So for both milk and placenta, there's this changing regime of value from waste, potential disgusting products that is feminized and disgusting, to golden liquid or golden tissue when in the hand of medical authorities that have the pedigree and the money to develop it into a supposedly safe product. And there's also a gender dynamic, because typically when you look at who owns and operates some of these biotech companies using these body materials, they're mostly men. So it's interesting that here the medical discourse would be the opposite of what the doctors you talk to seem to say, that, oh, milk and placenta are great once they are collected and used on a wide scale, but when it's people doing it on a small scale, that's bad and that's dangerous.
Because the safety cannot be guaranteed, and sort of public health kind of... Yeah. Panicking around it is probably one of those moral dimensions to it, yeah, as well. Yeah.
So I appreciate all of your comments. I just feel I'm not going to be able to respond to everything, but thank you so much.
So we are at the end of our time. I thank Mathilde incredibly for this really thought-provoking presentation. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
We look forward to
Thanks.
More of your work, more mapping and more prescriptions. Ivana, Alia, thank you so much for your comments. Thanks, everybody, for being here.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a lecture by Mathilde Cohen, professor of law at the University of Connecticut. Professor Cohen's lecture was titled Eating Women, the Regulation of Milk and Placenta Consumption in France and the United States, and was presented by the Boston University Pardee School of Global Studies. Tonight's moderator was Boston University professor of law Daniela Caruso. We also heard from discussants Ivana Isailovic, fellow Jean Monnet Center for International Law, New York University, and Alia Gusova, associate professor of sociology at Boston University. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You can also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth, with help from Matt Lissette. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Jack Lepiars. Thanks for joining us.